When you think of war, what's the first thing that comes to mind? Soldiers, weapons, bombs, explosions, destruction maybe. The history of war goes hand in hand with the history of humanity, but it's only in the last 100 years that we've gotten to see its true face. War isn't about battles, redistribution of resources, geopolitical ambitions, or some simplified struggle between good and evil. It is about people. It is the story of those whose name history has forgotten, who for months, years fought every day to survive, whether on the front lines or in the cities and settlements of their homeland. It is about the instinctive will to live, about the worry, fear, despair, and hope. The first to give them a face was Hungarian-born Robert Capa, the greatest war photographer in the world. With the help of Vivian Boroniak and István Virág Völgyi from the Robert Capa Contemporary Photography Center, we attempt to map out who Capa really was, why he is such a towering figure in the photography world, and what his legacy is.
As a photographer, Robert Capa established a genre of war photography that was not known before. And ever since him, no war photography can be taken the same way. It was partially connected to, obviously, the technical advancements at the time that he and his fellow photographers were more mobile so they could be on the spot of the events, which means that they could be directly reporting from the sites of world conflicts. But also that according to the words of the curator of the NOW, in the Working Hungarian exhibition at the Robert Capa Contemporary Photography Center, Gabriela Cizek, he was a participatory observant.
Robert Capa was unequivocally one of the most important photographers of the 20th century. While he did take photos of his friends and everyday life, it was the photos of the front lines he took as a war correspondent that made him world famous. He photographed five battles in just over 40 years of life. He was there during the Spanish Civil War and then at the Second Sino-Japanese War. In World War II, he reported from London, North Africa and Italy. He arrived with the first waves at Omaha Beach on D-Day and was the only photographer to document the Normandy landings and the Allied capture of Paris, Leipzig, Nuremberg and Berlin. He was there during the First Arab-Israeli War, and he documented the Indochina War. He was a passionate photographer, a true comrade who went through absolute hell alongside the soldiers. The phrase has since become a trademark. If your photos aren't good enough, you weren't close enough. This unbounded audacity was the cause of both his immense success and his tragically early death on the 25th of May 1954, when he stepped on a landmine in Vietnam and was killed. To his last, he was a true adventurer. A man with many homes, who lived without a passport, observed and participated in everything around him, and above all, was a fierce humanist.
He was truly curious about people, about situations. He wanted to be there. He wanted to be there first. And because of this, he was really close to his subjects. And his genuine interests just somehow come through the images. And you can, you know, feel the emotions that the people probably felt on his images. And I think this is important. He could somehow catch these little, you know, frictions of a second, where it's somehow everything comes together in a frame, and then you have a feeling that you can understand better what was going on.
But who was this man who was everywhere all the time and documenting everything? Robert Capa was born Endre Friedman in Budapest in 1913 to a well-to-do Jewish family running a tailor's shop. And by the time he entered high school, he was already showing an interest in journalism and photography. A major factor in this was his friendship with the renowned photographer Suzanne Sass, as well as Zsuzsa Sekely and Eva Bedentjer. In fact, he and Eva lived in the same building, and she was not only his first childhood love, but she also taught him a great deal about photography. His involvement in the left-wing protests on the 1st of September 1930, as well as his left-wing connections in general, landed him a brief stint in jail, from which, thanks to his parents' connections, he was released on the condition that he leave the country immediately. He wasn't even 18 years old when, in the July of 1931, he first moved to Vienna, then to Prague, and then on to Berlin, where he enrolled in the Deutsche Hochschule für Politik to study journalism and political science, while also serving as a darkroom assistant at the Deutsche Fotodienst Agency.
Historical circumstances at the time when Kappa began his career as a photographer were clearly surmounted by how a lot of people, due to political reasons, had to leave their countries. So we've seen a lot of talented people emigrating from, well, back then to the Eastern countries for cultural, for social, for religious reasons, and convening in already the bigger hubs of Europe, being Berlin, Paris, London, and then further on in the States. So Kappa arrived, when he leaves Hungary, he arrives first in Berlin and then in Paris into a network of émigrés for whom one of the connecting things was the expression of their creativity. Because a lot of them obviously didn't speak the language upon arrival. So they've been looking for, they found means to express their ideas, but most importantly, express their ideas to find ways of living. And then, for example, photography as such was a good way of living because you didn't have to speak the language of the country that you were at, but you could still speak, you could still make money, you could still get out there, still survive. These communities actually became almost like families to all these individuals. So they relied heavily upon each other. When someone was about to set out from their country, they almost immediately knew who to seek. They had a contact, then they were put into work. The same was for Kappa. So when he arrives in Berlin, then he very quickly gets a job, begins to work. Then he gets to take the picture of Trotsky and Copenhagen. And then we know the Kappa that we know.
The 1920s and 30s, when Kappa started to take pictures, were the so-called golden age of photojournalism. This was the time not only of technical advancement in photography, such as the camera becoming smaller and more portable, but also when photojournalism and print media became more advanced. This is the time of the appearance of many publishing houses for picture magazines, because mass production became possible and it was nicer to tell stories through images. But photographs were not just pictures. Through his photographs, Kappa was speaking, telling a story, even writing the story. Photographs were not supplementary material to the content or to the story. The photographs were the story. With the mass production of picture magazines, there was a higher demand for more photographers to be sent out into the world, because it was Kappa and his fellows who told the ladies and gentlemen in Paris, Manhattan, or South London about what's been going on in the world.
He believed that his stories will make a difference in the world, that if he reports about the events, then he's going to make a difference. Change people's minds, make them realize about the cruelsome nature of the human being. I mean, I don't want to go that deep into that because, of course, we don't know. But we do know that he must have understood that he needs to do something in order to reach the same.
Following the Nazi Party's rise to power, Kappa had to flee Berlin because of his Jewish heritage in 1933. He moved to Paris, where he shared a darkroom with Henri Cartier-Bresson and David Seymour, and worked as a freelance photographer from 1933 to 1939. He realized early on in his career that his foreign-sounding name, André Friedmann, didn't sound too good in international circles, so he and his lover, the German-born Goethe Pohorilla, changed their names, and thus Goethe Taro and Robert Kappa were born. Whether his name was taken from the then famous actor Robert Taylor, or perhaps the film director Frank Capra, or was even a play on his supposed nickname from school, Kappa meaning shark in Hungarian, no one really knows. But it worked. It was a fantastic pseudonym. It evoked the silver screen. It was cosmopolitan, uninhibited, difficult to identify by any ethnic or religious criteria. The perfect name for a wandering nomad. And the newspapers finally started to publish his photos.
What Gerda and Kappa did, or to go by the original names like Gerta and Andre or Endre did, was not only a name change, but also the fabrication of a personality. A personality who probably they believed was more attractive, was with the mystery, with coming from a faraway land, was more capable of catching attention. So that was new, and Kappa integrated this personality.
Robert Kappa was not merely a name which sounded good, but a standalone persona, an entity, a brand under whose name not only Friedman, but also Gerda and Seymour Heim published countless photos in the early years. This was when he received the assignment to cover the Spanish Civil War. The photos he took in Spain, among them one of his most famous and to this day disputed photos, The Falling Soldier, brought him instant worldwide fame, with the Picture Post magazine in 1938 naming him the greatest war photographer in the world.
He started to develop in the mid-30s, in 36 and 7 in Spain. He made a very famous photograph called The Falling Soldier. And what is important, I think, is one side of it is technical. So you already had really small cameras and very good quality negative films. You could really approach your subject because the camera wasn't too big and you could control it very easily. And you could take pictures in very bad conditions compared to earlier. So this is really very, very important technically. But obviously this is just part of the story.
In time, Friedman the photographer and Kappa became one and the same, and until the end of his life he played the role. In fact, he consciously built up the brand, the role of the charming, daring, roguish gambler. But his real personality was something of a mystery. His photos may be sharp, but anything we know about him or from him is exceptionally blurry.
He was a big storyteller, and you couldn't really sometimes differentiate between what it was made up and what was reality. So he wrote this autobiographical novel called Slightly Out of Focus. And if you read it, you somehow can sense that, you know, things are probably partly real, but partly made up. It's kind of blurry in a lot of instances, like which one is which. And Kappa didn't mind this at all. He gave a radio interview after this book was published, and he was asked about this, and he was just really cheeky again, because you could feel that it's not important for him. For him, the story is important.
He always knew. You can see it in his photographs. Like, he almost always knew what he had to do. Of course, with the idea of understanding as well that this can lead to his death, which eventually happened. But taking the risk, stepping forward, moving forward, constantly being on the go. And that required, as they understood, to change, to become something that he wasn't at the, like as Andre Friedman. So they changed the personality. He took on, he began to wear his hair differently. He put on suit, whereas before he was always a little bit shabby. So he integrated this personality, and that was a novelty. It was not to leave his Hungarian roots behind. It was not to, in fact, in a way, he wasn't an outsider with this, because then he became one in the community. But then to be someone who can be successful, who can reach the aim that he wanted to, which is, we believe that Kappa believed and wanted to make an effect with his photograph.
When World War II broke out, he moved to America and worked as a freelancer for Life, Time, and other publications. He was a war correspondent for Life and Collier's from 1941 to 1946 and traveled with the US Army. It was at this time that he shot the D-Day photo series known as the Magnificent 11. Kappa landed at Omaha Beach with the first waves of the American invasion. Kappa writes the following about the events in his book, slightly out of focus. The war correspondent has his stake, his life in his own hands, and he can put in on this horse or that horse, or he can put it back in his pocket at the very last minute. I am a gambler. I decided to go in with E Company in the first wave. The photo series has been widely celebrated, and it is said that Steven Spielberg was inspired by them when filming Saving Private Ryan.
War makes things really black and white in many cases. It made, and Kappa made his choice always, so you could always know which side he is on. And he made no secret out of it, so he didn't pursue some kind of objectivity, which is anyhow, you cannot achieve objectivity. Maybe you can achieve authenticity, but not objectivity. But he was not even pursuing this. He was on the Spanish Civil War. He was on one side in the Second World War, also with the Allied forces, obviously. It was also a big thing for him because he was from Hungary. So first he was considered an alien. So, and then he could argue with the officials, and he was granted permission to travel together with the American soldiers, which was a really big thing because they suspected spies everywhere.
Between assignments, Kappa lived in a room at the Hotel Lancaster in Paris. He had an incredible network of friends, which included Ernest Hemingway, John Steinbeck, Irwin Shaw, Pablo Picasso, Henri Cartier-Bresson, and others.
Whoever he met, he became friends with, and then they created things together. Also, in the very profession that he worked with, I mean, if you're talking about photography, he was an organizing force. So a lot of these things happened, like I said before, because of his interest in the material that he was seeking out. The Magnum photos, as it is, was established because of a desire to create something together. So it is interesting because, of course, with a camera, you're a lonely person because you see, it's you who sees something through the lens, and you take the picture like that. But in a lot of projects, he was working together with other people, and I think that the network that he was a part of, when it comes to friends and the things that everybody knows about, that Kappa liked champagne, that Kappa liked was a gambler, that Kappa liked women. These are these ideas, but you can never forget that this person was at gunpoint, probably, or was very close to death all the time. So if we're talking about PTSD or all that, he needed to let go from time to time. And then you find the people with whom you can do that. And if you're a creative person, then you begin to do some things together.
Cartier-Bresson wrote of his friend, "For me, Kappa wore the dazzling matador's costume, but he never went in for the kill. A great player, he fought generously for himself and for others in a whirlwind. Destiny was determined that he should be struck down at the height of his glory."
He thought that, you know, life is in the essence of a second. You know, you have to be there, you have to, you know, live life there. You have to have one goal to, you know, tell the big picture what is with the world, what is happening in society and with people.
Despite the fact that he became famous as a war photographer, Kappa hated war. He once said, "The war photographer's most fervent wish is for unemployment. It is not always easy to stand aside and be unable to do anything except record the suffering around one." The legacy of Robert Kappa, besides having a monumental effect on the genre of war photography, is undoubtedly Magnum Photo, a photo cooperative he founded along with fellow photographers included David Hym Seymour, Henri Cartier-Bresson, George Roger, William van der Vert, Rita van der Vert, and Maria Eisner back in 1947.
Kappa as we know, so at the time we are talking about photojournalism, where we are talking about journalism living its heyday, there are a lot of photographers taking images, they are sending them to editorial rooms and magazines are printed. However, the names of the photographers are often not included in the photo reports. Because back then, and today, this might not be imaginable, although I am wondering how many people are actually looking at the credits of a photograph in a picture magazine or in a newspaper, but the photographs were not credited to the photographers. And most likely, there was an incident in 35 when one of Kappa's photos taken of the Paris Stock Exchange was used by a German Nazi-related magazine to actually prove a very different point than what Kappa believed in. And that made him think about, that's why we call him a pioneer or a forward thinker, or someone who's always looking for ways to change things or make a difference, to think about the ways that photographers can begin to safeguard their work, to take full ownership, and then to actually generate possible income from them.
Kappa was a mentor for many photographers. He himself invited photographers into Magnum and is now present in Magnum's educational activities. From 1935 to 1947, they developed the system of operations of a photography collective which is not dependent on any kind of outside source, but only on their work, which protects their credit and their own work. They divided the world among themselves. So while each photographer got to report from a particular part of the world and give that one voice to that one area, Kappa was the only one who got to go wherever he wanted.
As a cultural phenomenon, obviously we are mesmerized by the adventurer, by the guy who's been surrounded by women as much as we know, by the guy who one day was in Paris, the next day he jumped out of an airplane in England, then was playing cards with Hemingway or had parties. So we like this kind of lively personality. But most importantly, or if these were not important, one of the other important thing definitely about him is the humanism with which he looked at the world, and with his fellow photographers with whom he established Magnum Photos in 1947. They were what Cartier-Bresson called them adventurers of ethics, like ethical adventurers, because they were not just photographing the war, but they were kind of like examples of free will, of free decision, of having that kind of making atypical decisions in typical situations, kind of pushing people to see that they are responsible for the things that are happening around them.
Even 75 years later, Magnum is one of the biggest professional legacies or heritage he could have left behind. Beyond the idea of protecting copyrights, Magnum also showed the way that Kappa looked at things, the way that they all looked at the world, and the way that even today Magnum operates, albeit, of course, in a different sense.
Kappa made it really easily understandable that you have to reach your audience, and you have to provide the audience with what it expects from you. So you really have to go up close, and you really have to be in the middle of things. And you really have to see everything for yourself to be able to report for others. This was a new thing still at the Second World War. In the First World War, if you look at photographs, they are really almost staged. Even if they were not staged, they kind of struck you as really very static. And you don't see any emotions at all. And everybody's playing a role kind of for a camera. And I think Kappa really wasn't interested in this, and he could actually make new types of images. And basically, he started war reporting, the kind of war reporting that is still around today. He was the first one. And I think war photographers today, they would really be happy if they could, you know, take pictures like Kappa did. A lot of time have passed, and his work is still good. We still consider him good and very relevant. And not just because of the contents of the images, but because of, you know, all the composition and everything about the photographs themselves. But I think what is most important when it comes to Kappa is his innovative spirit. This is what we have to take away from Kappa's story, I'm pretty sure. Embracing always the new things, you know, making adventures and trying this and trying that and really tirelessly going forward and not sitting around and trying to think about the meaning of things rather than the cliches, you know, like we normally do business like this, okay, but I will form a cooperative agency. I don't care how we normally do business, I'll do it my way.
Of course, it's a cliche by now, but we know that his famous saying that if your pictures are not good enough, you were not close enough. I think it very clearly indicates or describes to us what it is that Kappa believed, is that you have to be embedded, you have to get close to your subject. It wasn't so much about physical proximity, although of course that too, but that you have to be involved in the situation, that you have to care. And this kind of care, this kind of belief was definitely translated into how he developed the stories that he worked on, that he believed that his images, reporting about the events, the various events of the world at the time, are going to make the world a better place, that they are going to wake people up, that they are going to make people realize that, for example, when they traveled with Steinbeck to the USSR, there are notes of his from later on where we see that he says, well, they are the same people. Regardless of what one side of the world, politics, is trying to tell us, I am here to tell you that these people are the same people. They have children, they want to survive, they want to raise their children. So just there is life behind the Iron Curtain, and we have to see that life is with the same struggles and the same questions that we have.
Robert Capa photographed countless battles and five wars, starting with the Spanish Civil War in 1936 and finishing with the French Indochina War in 1954, where he sadly lost his life after stepping on a landmine in Vietnam. He lived hardly 40 years, but he was present in taking photos at almost every monumental event of his time. His photos, such as The Falling Soldier, The Normandy Landings, Hemingway with his son, or Picasso on the beach, are all emblematic documentations of the 20th century. His work, his attitude, and the humanity with which he traveled about for decades documenting the world are still defining to this day. Kappa's friend and fellow artist, John Steinbeck, with whom he traveled to the Soviet Union in 1947, the experiences of which led to their book The Russian Diary, summarized the essence of both Robert Kappa and his work as follows. Kappa was able to see and use what he had discovered. He was able to show the whole population's hatred on a child's face. Kappa's work is the proof of his great heart and his exuberant compassion. I frequently traveled and worked with Kappa. He may have had much closer friends, but nobody liked him as much as I did. He liked to seem to be easy and carefree in his work. But he was not. His photos are not accidental.